Hachette Audio presents Gods of Risk, an Expanse novella. Written by James S. A. Corey. Read by Eric Davies.
What kind of problem?
Hutch asked. Even though he was from the settlements near Mariner Valley, he didn't have the relaxed, drawling accent of that part of Mars. Hutch's voice buzzed like a radio on just the wrong frequency.
It's not bad,
Lily said, leaping to his defense.
It's not bad, right, David? Not really a problem. Inconvenience, maybe.
Inconvenience, David echoed. The silence was uncomfortable. David tugged his fingers, pulling each one straight out from the hand until the knuckle popped, then moving on to the next. He was half a head taller than Hutch, but he couldn't seem to bring his gaze up higher than the thin man's sternum. In 2 months, David would be 16, but he felt about 6. Hutch's meetings were always in small rooms, away from the main passages and corridors. This one had been a storage hole from the first generation of settlements. The walls were the polished stone of Mars, covered with a clear, insulative ceramic that was starting to bubble and gray with age. The light was a construction lantern, the burning white of the LED softened and made ruddy by Lily's paisley silk scarf draped over it. They sat on metal crates in the cold. Hutch scratched at the scars on his wrist.
Don't let it choke you, little man,
Hutch said. It was an old joke between them. David's family were Polynesian before they were Martian, and between genetics and growing up at barely over a third of Terran G, David was over 2 meters tall and leaning toward pudgy.
Just say what it is. You got a bad batch, right?
No, nothing like that. The batch is fine. It's just my Aunt Bobby's come to live with us for a while. She's always at the place now. Always. Anytime I get home, she's there.
Hutch frowned and tilted his head. Lily put her arm around his shoulder, draping herself close to the man. Hutch shrugged her back, but not off.
She knows you're cooking?
She doesn't know anything, David said. She just lifts weights and watches video feeds all day.
Lifts weights?
Hutch asked. There was an undercurrent of amusement in his voice that made David's guts unknot. He risked a glance at the thin man's tea-brown eyes.
She used to be a Marine.
Used to be?
Something weird happened. She sort of quit.
So, not a Marine anymore. And now what is she?
Just a fucking inconvenience,
David said. He took a little joy in the profanity. Hell and damn were the worst language tolerated in the Draper house. Fuck would have gotten him yelled at. Worse than that would be unthinkable. The batch is fine, but it's going to be harder to get the next one done. I can't do any of the prep work at home now. Hutch leaned back, his laughter filling the air. Lily's face relaxed, all the little worry lines vanishing back into the eggshell smoothness of her skin.
Shit,
Hutch said.
You had me thinking there was trouble for a minute there. Thought I was going to have to tell my people that my best cook fell down.
David picked up his satchel, fumbled through it, and came out with a rattling plastic jar. Hutch took it, cracked the seal, and poured 4 or 5 of the small pink lozenges into his hand, then passed one to Lily. She popped it in her mouth like it was hard candy. The 2,5-dimethoxy-4-N-propylthiophenethylamine was a serotonin receptor agonist that broke down into, among other things, a 2,5-desmethoxy derivative that was a monoamine oxidase A inhibitor. The euphoric effects would start to tighten Lily's joints and lift her mood in the next half hour. The hallucinations wouldn't kick in for an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and then they'd last her through the night. She rattled the lozenge across the back of her teeth with her tongue, grinning at him. David felt the first stirrings of an erection and looked away from her.
"You do good work, little man,"
Hutch said, taking out his hand terminal. The small chime meant the transfer was done. David's secret account had a little more money in it. Not that he was in this for the money.
"Now this auntie thing, what's it going to do to your schedule?"
"I've still got the lab at school," David said. "I can sign up for more time there. Seniors get preference, so it won't be too hard. It's just..."
"Yeah, no," Hutch said. "Better we play safe. You tell me how much time you need to make the next batch. That's how much time you can take."
"I'm thinking a couple weeks at least," David said.
"Take them, they're yours,"
Hutch said, waving his scarred hand.
"We're in this for the long haul, you and me. No reason to get greedy now."
"Yeah." The thin man stood up. David was never sure how old Hutch really was. Older than him and Lily, and younger than David's parents. That gulf of years seemed to fill infinite possibilities. Hutch shrugged on his dust-red overcoat and pulled his brown-knit toque out of a pocket, flapped it once like he was whipping the air, and pulled it down over white blonde hair. Lily stood up with him, but Hutch put a hand on her bare shoulder, turning the girl toward David.
"You see my girl here back to the land of the living, eh, little man? I got a thing to do."
"All right," David said. Lily pulled her scarf off the lantern, and the dirty little room went brighter. Hutch gave a mocking three-finger salute, then unsealed the door and left. The rule was that Hutch left first, and then, 10 minutes later, David could go. He didn't know exactly where Hutch went, and if Lily was here with him, he didn't care. She leaned against him, smelling like verbena and girl. She was a year older than him, and he could have rested his chin on the top of her head.
"You're doing all right?" he asked.
"Am,"
she said, her voice slushy and soft.
"It's starting to come on."
"That's good."
He gathered her a little closer. She rested her head against his chest, and they waited quietly for the precious minutes to pass. 7 communities, called the neighborhoods, scattered throughout the northern reach of the Aurora Sinus, made up Londres Nova. The city, such as it was, had burrowed deep into the flesh of Mars, using the soil as insulation and radiation shielding, with only 10 domes pressing out to the surface. 40,000 people lived and worked there, carving new life into the unforgiving stone of humanity's second home. Tube stations made a simple web topology that determined the social forms and structures. Atterpal was the only station with connections to every other neighborhood, and so it became the de facto downtown. Salton was under the biggest agricultural dome and had a surface monorail to the observatory at Donbad Nova, and so the upper university and technical clinics were concentrated there. The lower university was in Breach Candy, where David and his family lived. Nariman and Martinez Town had been manufacturing and energy production sites in the first wave of colonization, and the displacement that came with new technologies meant both neighborhoods were struggling to reinvent and repurpose themselves. Innis Deep and Innis Shallows Each had only a single tube route out, making them cul-de-sacs and havens for the sort of Martian who was almost a belter, antisocial, independent, and intolerant. An address in either Innis was the mark of an outsider, someone dangerous or vulnerable. Lily lived in the shallows, and Hutch lived in the deep. As much as the neighborhoods differed, the tube stations were the same, high, arched ceilings bright with full-spectrum light and chaotic with echoes. Thin-film video monitors pasted to the walls, blaring public information and entertainment feeds. Kiosks selling food and clothes, the latest fads and fashions cycled in and out as regularly as tides. Security cameras looked down on everything, identity-matching software tweaking the video feeds to put names with faces in the crowd. The air always seemed to have the faint scents of ozone and cheap food and piss. The plastic film flyers always looked the same whether they were announcing yoga classes, lost pets, or independent music acts. David had been to the cities in Mariner Valley and the base of Olympus Mons, and the tube stations had been the same there, too. The one unifying cultural product of Mars. David led Lily through the bustle of the Martinez Town station. He shifted his satchel so that she could put her arm around his. The farther they walked, the less steady her steps were. Her arm curled around him like ivy clinging to a pillar, and he could feel the stiffness in her muscles and hear it in her voice when she spoke. Her pupils were dilating with pleasure and the chemical cascade in her brain. He wondered what she was seeing.
"You never try this stuff yourself?"
she asked again, unaware that it was the third time. "No," David said again. "I'm finishing up my senior labs. There isn't really time for a night off. Later, maybe, when I get my placement."
"You're so smart,"
she said.
"Hutch always says how you're so smart."
Ahead of them, near the platform, a crowd of something close to 50 people were chanting together and holding up signs. A dozen uniformed cops stood a few yards away, not interfering, but watching closely. David ducked his head and turned Lily away at an angle. Maybe if they headed toward the restrooms, there would be a way to the platform that didn't involve walking a tripping girl past the police. Not that the police were paying much attention to the foot traffic. Their attention was all on the protest. The signs were hand-lettered or printed on standard-sized paper and glued together. A couple had thin-film monitors playing looped images that fuzzed out to a psychedelic rainbow swirl when the signs flexed. "Hit back!" and "Are we waiting until they kill us?" and "Earth started it. Let's finish it." This last slogan was accompanied by a bad homemade animation of a rock slamming into the earth, a massive molten impact crater looking like a bloody bullet wound in the planet. The protesters were a mixed group, but most were a little older than David or Lily. Blood-dark faces and the square-gaped mouths sent the sense of rage radiating out from them like heat. David paused, trying to make out what exactly they were chanting through the echoes, but all he could tell was that it had 7 syllables, 4 in a call and 3 in response. One of the police shifted, looking at David, and he started walking again. It wasn't his fight. He didn't care. By the time they reached the platform, Lily had gone quiet. He led her to a formed plastic bench that was intended for 3 people, but was snug with just the 2 of them. It ticked and popped under his weight, and Lily flinched from the sound. There were small, distressed lines between her brows. The arrival board listed 6 minutes for the tube that would eventually get them to Innis Shallows. the seconds counting down in clean-lined Arabic numerals. When Lily spoke, her voice was tight. He didn't know if it was from sadness or the expected side effect of the drug.
"Everybody's so angry," she said. "I just wish people weren't so angry."
"They've got reason to be."
Her focus swam for a moment, her gaze fighting to find him.
"Everyone's got reasons to be," she said. "I've got reasons to be, you've got reasons to be. Doesn't mean we are, though. Doesn't mean we want to be. You aren't angry, are you, David?"
The question ended almost like a plea, and he wanted to tell her that he wasn't. He wanted to say whatever words would smooth her perfect brow and then take her back to her room in the housing complex and kiss her and have her strip off his clothes. He wanted to see her naked and hear her laugh and fall asleep, spent in her arms. He coughed, shifting on the bench.
"You aren't angry, are you?"
she asked again. The soft tritone sounded.
"The tube car's here,"
he said, forcing a smile.
"Everything's going to be fine. Just relax, right?"
She nodded and tried to pull away from him.
"It's all red. You're red, too, like a great big cherry. You're so smart," she said. "So you never try the stuff yourself?"
On the tube car, things weren't better. This leg of the trip was an express for Atterpal, and the men and women on it were older than he was by a decade. Their demographic weight had the public monitor set to a news feed. In some well-appointed newsroom on the planet, a thin, gray-haired man was shouting down a swarthy woman.
"I don't care," the man said. "The agent they weaponized came from some larger extrasolar ecosystem, and I don't care. I don't care about Phoebe. I don't care about Venus. What I care about is what they did. The fact is, and no one disputes this, the fact is that Earth bought those weapons and..."
"That's a gross oversimplification. Evidence is that there were several bids, including one from..."
"Earth bought those weapons, and they fired them at us. At you and me and our children and grandchildren."
The door slid silently closed, and the car began its acceleration. The tubes themselves were in vacuum, the car riding on a bed of magnetic fields like a Gauss round. The lurch of acceleration was gentle, though. They'd cover the distance to Atterpal in 20 minutes, maybe less. Lily closed her eyes and rested her head against the back of the car, her lips pressed thin and her grip on his arm tightened. Maybe they should have waited for her to take the pill until she'd gotten to someplace quieter and better controlled.
"And Earth also provided the tracking data that shot them all down,"
the woman on the screen said, pointing at the gray-haired man with her whole hand.
"Yes, a rogue element in the Earth military was involved, but to dismiss the role that the official sanctioned military played..."
"Sanctioned military? You make it sound like there's a civil war on Earth. I don't see that. I don't see that at all. I see Mars under a persistent existential threat and the government sitting on its hands."
"Tell me a story," Lily said. "Talk to me. Sing me a song. Something."
"I've got music on the hand terminal if you want."
"No," she said. "You. Your voice."
David tucked his satchel between his feet and turned toward her, dipping his head down close to her ear. He had to hunch a little. He licked his lips, trying to think of something. His mind was blank, and he grabbed at the first thought that came through him. He brought his mouth to the shell of her ear. When he sang, he tried to be quiet enough that no one else would hear him.
"Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen.
Lily didn't open her eyes, but she smiled. That was good enough. For 10 minutes, David went on, quietly singing Christmas carols to Lily. Some he got into and didn't remember the right words, so he just made things up. Nonsense that fit the rhythm of the music, or nearly did. The detonation was the loudest thing David had ever heard, less a sound than a physical blow. The car pitched forward, rattling against the walls of the tube, throwing Lily into him and then back. The lighting flickered, failed, and then came on in a different color. They were stopped between stations. The monitors clicked to a pinkish gray as they rebooted, then glowered back to life with the emergency services trefoil.
"Is this happening?"
Lily asked. Her irises were tiny rings of brown around deep black.
"David, is this happening?"
"It is. It's all right," he said. "I'm here. We're fine."
David checked his hand terminal, thinking that the news feeds might tell him what was going on. Power failure, rioting, enemy attack. But the network was in lockdown. An almost supernaturally calm male voice came over the public monitors.
"The public transport system has encountered a pressure anomaly and has been shut down to assure passenger safety. Stay calm and a maintenance crew will arrive shortly."
The message was less important than the tone of voice it was spoken in, and Lily relaxed a little. She started to giggle.
"Well, this is fucked,"
she said, and grinned at him.
"Fucked, fucked, 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 fucked."
"Yeah,"
David said. His mind was already jumping ahead. He'd be late getting home. His father would want to know why. And when it came out he'd been in Martinez Town, there'd be questions. What he'd been doing there, who he had been seeing, why hadn't he told anybody? All around them, the other passengers were grumbling and sighing and arranging themselves into comfortable positions, waiting for the rescuers. David stood up and sat down again. Every passing minute seemed to relax Lily and shunt that tension into his spine. When he caught a glimpse of his reflection in the glass of the tube doors, the boy looking back seemed furtive and scared. Half an hour later, the emergency hatch at the end of the car creaked, popped, and opened. A man and a woman in matching blue security uniforms stepped in.
"Hey, folks," the man said. "Everyone all right? Sorry about this, but some jackhole broke the vacuum seals. Whole system's going to be down for about 6 hours, minimum. Some places longer. We've got service carts out here that can take folks to transport buses. Just line up, single file, and we'll get you where you're going."
Lily was humming to herself as David drew her into line. He couldn't get her to Innisshallow and back home, not with the tubes down. He bit his lips, and they moved forward one at a time, the other passengers vanishing through the emergency hatch and into the temporary airlock beyond it. It took forever to reach the front of the line.
"Where are you two headed?"
the security man asked, consulting his hand terminal. It was working, even though David's wasn't. The man looked up, concerned.
"Hermano, where are you two headed?"
"Innisshallows?"
David said, and then,
"She's going to Innisshallows. I was taking her there because she's not feeling so good. But I've got to get to Breach Candy. I'm going to miss my labs."
Lily stiffened.
"Innisshallows and Breach Candy. Step on through."
The temporary airlock was made from smooth black mylar, and walking through it was like going through the inside of a balloon. The pressure wasn't calibrated very well, and when the outer seal opened, David's ears popped. The hall was wide and low, the dull orange emergency lights filling the passage with shadows and leaching the color out of everything. The air was at least 5 degrees colder, enough to summon goose flesh, and Lily wasn't holding his arm anymore. Her eyebrows were lifted, and her mouth was set.
"It'll be okay," he said as they came close to the electric carts. "They'll get you home all right."
"Yeah, fine," she said.
"I'm sorry. I've got to get home. My dad."
She turned to him. In the dim light, her dilated eyes didn't seem as out of place. Her sobriety made him wonder how much she'd really been feeling it before, and how much had been a playful kind of acting.
"Don't worry about it," she said. "Not the first time I've been tripping in public, right? I can behave myself. Just thought you'd come play, and I was wrong. Hard cheese for me, and moving on now. I'm sorry. Next time."
"You call it,"
she said with a shrug.
"Next time."
The driver of the cart for Innis Shallow called out, and Lily clambered aboard, squeezed between a middle-aged man and a grandmotherly woman, and waved back at David once. The middle-aged man glanced at David, back at Lily, then down at the girl's body. The cart lurched, whined, and lurched again. David stood, watching it pull away. The mixture of shame, regret, and longing felt like an illness. Someone touched his elbow.
"Breach candy?"
"Yes."
"Over here, then." "Damn, you're a big one, aren't you? All right, though, we'll fit you in."
It was 2 years almost to the day since David had met Hutch at the lower university. David had been in the commons, the wide, carpeted benches with their soft, organic curves, welcoming the students eating lunch. At 13, David had already been biochemistry track for 2 years. His last labs had been in tRNA transport systems, and he was reading through the outline for the carbon complex work that would take up his next 6 months when one of the seniors, an olive-skinned boy named Alwasi, had sat down beside him and said there was someone David should meet. Hutch had made himself out as more of a scholar back then, but still with an edge to him. For months, David had thought the man was an independent tutor, the kind of hired instructor a family might bring on if their children were falling behind. David still had 7 rounds of lab to go before his placement, so he hadn't thought too much about Hutch. He'd just become another face in the whirl of the lower university, one more minor character in the cast of thousands, or hundreds at least. Looking back, David could sort of see how Hutch had tested him. It had begun with asking innocuous little favors. Tell someone who shared David's table that Hutch was looking for her. Get Hutch a few grams of some uncontrolled reagent. Keep a box for him overnight. They were things that David could do easily, and so he did. Every time, Hutch praised him or paid him back with small favors. David began to notice the people Hutch knew, pretty girls and tough-looking men. Several of the low-tier instructors knew Hutch on sight, and if they weren't overly friendly to him, they were certainly respectful. There hadn't been any one moment when David had crossed a line from being someone Hutch knew to cooking for him. It all happened so smoothly that he'd never felt a bump. The fact was, he would have done the side projects for Hutch without being paid. He couldn't spend the money on anything too extravagant for fear his parents would ask questions, so he used it here and there, a little present for Lily, or lunch on him for the other students at his table, or the occasional indulgence that he could explain away. For the most part, it just sat in the account, growing slowly over time. The money wasn't precious because it was money. It was precious because it was secret, and it was his. When he had his placement and moved out to student housing in Salton, he'd have more freedom. Hutch's money would buy him a top-flight gaming deck or a better wardrobe. He could take Lily out for fancy dinners without having to explain where he'd been or who he'd been with. The workload would be harder, especially if he got placed in medical or development. He'd heard stories about first-year placements on the development teams who pulled 56-hour shifts without sleep. Carving out another 6 hours after that for Hutch might be hard, but he'd worry about that when he got there. He had more immediate problems. The transport buses were old, wheezing electrical carts, some of them dating back 2 generations. The drivetrain clicked under him, and the rubberized foam wheels made a constant sticky ripping noise. David hunched in a seat, trying to pull his elbows close in against his body. Around him, the other travelers looked bored and restless. The system was still locked down, his hand terminal restricted to what it held in local memory. He checked it every few seconds just to feel he had something to do. The wide access corridors passed slowly, the conduits and pipes like the circulatory system of some vast planetary behemoth. It seemed like the corridor would go on forever, even though the distance between Martinez Town and Breach Candy wasn't more than 40 kilometers. He was supposed to be in his labs at the lower university. Even if all the public transport was locked down, it wasn't more than a half-hour walk from there to home. David figured he could claim to have been in the middle of something, and that it had taken longer than he'd expected to finish up the work. Except that was the excuse he'd been giving to cover the extra time he'd spent cooking for Hutch. His mother had already started wondering in her vague, accusation-without-confrontation way whether he was losing focus on his work. If they found out he'd been outside the neighborhood, it would be bad. If they found out why, it would be apocalyptic. David cracked his knuckles and willed the bus to go faster. It was easy to think of Londres Nova as existing only along its tube lines, but the truth was, generations of colonists and proto-terraformers had made a webwork of tunnels under the airless permafrost of Mars. Whole complexes of the original tunnels had gone fallow, sealed off, and the atmosphere and heat allowed to flow away into the flesh of the planet. Supply passages linked to electrical maintenance lines. There were shortcuts, and the bus driver knew them. Just when David was about to weep or scream with frustration, he saw the edge of Levantine Park and the northernmost edge of Breach Candy. The bus was going faster than he could walk, but just knowing where he was, being able to map his own way home, made the frustration a little less, and the fear maybe a little more. "I didn't do anything wrong," he told himself. "I was in my lab. There was a security alert and the network went down. I had to finish the experiment and it took a little longer because everyone was trying to find out what had happened. That's all. Nothing else." The fifth time the bus stopped, he was as close to his family's hole as he was going to be. He lumbered out into the corridors of his hometown, his head down and his shoulders tucked in toward his chest, like he was trying to protect something. The family lived in a series of 8 rooms dug out of the stone and finished with textured organics. Rich brown bamboo floors met soft mushroom brown walls. The lights were indirect LEDs, alleged to match a sunny afternoon on Earth. To David, they were just the color house lights were. A newsfeed was muttering in the common rooms. so some portion of the system must have been taken off security lockdown. David closed the door behind him and stalked through the kitchen, fists against his thighs, breath shallow and fast. Aunt Bobby was alone in the den. In any other family, she'd have been huge. For a draper, she was only about the middle of the bell curve in height, but athletic and strong. She wore a simple loose-cut outfit that lived somewhere between sweats and pajamas. It mostly hid the shape of her body. She looked away from the video feed, her dark eyes meeting his, and killed the sound. On the screen, a reporter was speaking earnestly into the camera. Behind him, a lifting mech was hauling a slab of ferrocrete. "Where's Dad?" he asked.
"Stuck in Salton with your mom," Bobby said. "The blowout was on that line. Security's saying they'll have everything moving again in about 10 hours. But your father said they'd probably be taking a room and coming home in the morning."
David blinked. No one was going to give him any grief. It should have felt like relief. He shrugged, trying to get the tension out of his shoulders, but it wouldn't go. He knew it didn't make sense to be irritated with his parents for not being there to fight with.
"Do we know what happened?" he asked, stepping into the room.
"Sabotage," Aunt Bobby said.
"Someone blew a hole between the tube and the maintenance corridor. Sucked in a few thousand kilos of air. They took the vacuum seals offline, too, so the whole tube system popped like a balloon."
"Earth?" Aunt Bobby shook her head.
"Earth doesn't think that small," she said. "This is someone local, trying to start something."
"Why would someone local blow up our own stuff if they're mad at Earth?"
"Because Earth's too far away?"
It didn't sound like an answer to his question, but David let it go with another shrug. Aunt Bobby's gaze was on the monitor and not on it. Through it, seeing something else. He knew she'd been on Ganymede when the fighting started and that something had happened so that she wasn't in the military anymore and she had to live with them. The unfairness of her bringing her problems into his house chafed. She sighed and forced a smile.
"How'd things go at the lab?"
"All right," he said.
"What are you working on?"
"Just labs," he said, not looking at her.
"Your dad said he expected your placement to come through soon. Find out what you'll be doing for the next 8 years?"
"Guess." Aunt Bobby smiled.
"I remember when I first got into training. There was a breakdown in the notification system, and they wound up losing my placement for about 6 days. I was chewing through rocks until it came through. What about you? Are you more excited, scared, or pissed off?"
"I don't know," he said.
"Your dad's really proud of you," Aunt Bobby said. "Whatever happens, he's going to be really proud of you."
David felt the flush of warmth rising in his neck and cheeks. For a second, he thought he was embarrassed, but then he recognized the rage. He clamped his jaw tight and looked at the monitor so that he wouldn't be looking at Aunt Bobby. The mech was gesturing to a ragged hole 2 meters high and half a meter wide. The man controlling it, speaking to the reporter as steel claws pointed out the fine cracks fanning unpredictably out from the breach. David's teeth ached, and he made himself relax his jaw. Aunt Bobby turned back to the screen. He couldn't read her expression, but he had the feeling that he'd exposed something about himself he didn't want her to know.
"We have anything for dinner?"
"I didn't make anything," she said.
"Could, though."
"It's all right. I'll grab a bowl of rice. I have work I need to do. Lab stuff."
"Okay."
David's room was in the back. It had been cut from the ground with the image of a standard-sized person, and so it felt cramped to him. A standard bed would have left half a meter between the footboard and the wall. David's was almost flush. The gaming deck, the only thing he'd ever spent Hutch's illicit money on, sat at the side of the desk. The wall was set to a still from Gods of Risk, where Kaz Pratihari was about to duel Mickey Suhanam, both men looking strong, dangerous, and a bit melancholy. When the door was locked, he switched the wall to his favorite picture of Una Meng and threw himself to the bed. The newsfeed muttered from the common room, and under it, almost too faint to make out, Aunt Bobby's slow, rhythmic grunting. Resistance training, probably. He wished he could make all the noises go away, that he could have the house to himself for once. He wondered if Lily was all right, if she'd made it home safe, if she was angry with him or disappointed. His hand terminal chimed. The alert was from the lower university. In response to the terrorist attack on the tube lines, the labs would be closed the following day. Students with ongoing work that couldn't sit for an extra day were to reply to the section proctor, who would either give them special authorization to come in or else do part of the work for them. He ran through a mental checklist. He didn't have anything that needed him to be there, and if he got a little behind, everyone else would too. He didn't have any of Hutch's reagents in his lab, so if there was a security audit, he'd be all right. He had a day off, then. Lily's voice spoke in his memory. You never try the stuff yourself? Right now, somewhere in Innis Shallow, Lily's brain chemistry was cascading through a long series of biochemical waterfalls, one imbalance slipping to another, slipping to another. Her visual cortex firing in strange waves, her hippocampus blurring. He rolled to his side, reached between the bed frame and the wall, and plucked out the little felt bag. The pink lozenge looked tiny in his vast palm. It tasted like strawberry flavoring and dextrose. David laced his fingers behind his head, looked at the woman on his wall, looking back at him, and waited, waited, waited for the euphoria to come.